Okay, good evening all. So let's get started. We have a kind of a tight schedule here tonight because Slichos at the shul is at 10:15 and people need to get from home to the shul. So let's get started. First, I just want to begin by thanking our very special sponsors, Howie and Stacy Nathanson, who are sponsoring our Shabbat Shuva Drasha tonight in memory of their beloved brother, Bruce Ritholtz, Baruch Leib Ben Mordechai Yidel HaKohen, Zatzal, who is... The seventh year site was commemorated yesterday, and we just hope and pray that all of the words of Torah shared this evening should serve as an aliyah for his very special neshama. So the topic that we have is kind of an odd one. The title itself is interesting. Most people don't... it's hard to kind of connect to what the title is, but I'm hoping that with our introduction, which will be pretty brief, we'll get a general sense of what we're hoping to accomplish tonight. So over Rosh Hashanah, we began a conversation about the notion of routine, that we said that Yitzchak Avinu is the paradigm of Gevura. He's the essence of what it means to have a routine, to have consistency. And there are many different types of routines, right? There are the good types and there are the bad kinds. The good routines, if you kind of think for an English word to define or to explain a good habit or a good routine or a good ritual, there aren't many words. You have to kind of put the word good in there to make it sound positive. But if you want to talk about bad routines, so there are many words for that. You can use words like addictions, or you can use words like habit, which kind of does many, more often than not, connote something bad or something negative. Just going to ask everyone to mute themselves, if you don't mind. Or I'll mute you. Okay. So knowing that there are really these kind of negative addictions or negative habits, and then the positive habits that we might have, I kind of wanted to be led to a discussion of recognizing that there is some clear connection, most likely, between the notion of an addiction or a habit, and maybe even sin itself, to the essence and understanding of what teshuvah is all about. I'm sorry, someone is still unmuted. Okay. Sorry. Okay. So with that, I really have three questions that I want to focus on this evening. And through these three questions, I'm hoping that our goal will become somewhat clear. And that is the first question. I want to understand, are we addicted to sinning? Which is such a crazy question to say, because we're all pretty good people. The notion that we would be addicted to sinning is kind of a crazy and a harsh idea. But the truth is, when you think about it, the Gemara explains that there are three categories of people. There are the Rishayim, there are the Tzadikim, and the Beinonim, the wicked, the righteous, and the people who are in the middle. And we have to assume that we are all middle-of-the-road kind of people. And if we are middle-of-the-road kind of people, what that means is that 50% of our actions are good, but 50% of our actions are also bad. And if that's true, that 50% of what we do is bad, it's a crazy notion to say such a thing. That means that half the time we are doing something wrong. If we believe that sin is a negative thing, that sin has adverse consequences, that means that we are continuously doing something that can hurt us or that can negatively impact us. And as we'll see in just a minute, that is the definition of addiction itself. So that's the first question. Are we addicted to sinning? Sorry. If everyone just doesn't mind muting themselves, I'd appreciate it. Thank you so much. Okay. So that's the first question. Are we addicted to sinning? The second question is that, in contrast to that, are we deeply connected to God? Are we deeply rooted in our religion and our faith? Are we, maybe in a word, addicted to being a spiritual individual? And if the answer is no, or why not, or we sort of have a cringe kind of a response to that question, why not? Why is it so much easier to commit averus, to sin, than it is to be a good Jew, to be a good person of faith? Those are the first two questions. And the final question is trying to understand how the COVID pandemic has impacted all of this thus far, and how we can maybe capitalize on this pandemic to rid ourselves of the potential addictions that we have in our own lives. That was the first part of the introduction. The second part of the introduction is that I want to just kind of preface this with one additional statement, and that is this past summer, I had the great honor of taking a course on addictions, and I was really enamored by the reality that so many of us are likely addicts, at least according to the definition of what an addict is, without even knowing about it. Because the truth is that addictions, although when we say an addict, we think of a drug addict or an alcoholic, the definition of addiction goes way beyond how we really normally define it. And that is why I think it's really pertinent for all of us to understand what addiction actually is. And therefore, that's why the first part of the shiur is about defining addiction. I'm just going to resend the source sheet since a number of people joined since we started. And so it's in the chat over there. Feel free to follow along with me. So our first part this evening is trying to focus on defining addiction. If you take a look at source number one, it's from the National Institute of Drug Abuse. Okay, so we're going to be talking about drug addiction for just a moment. And here is the definition that they give. Addiction is defined as a chronic relapsing disorder characterized by compulsive drug seeking and use despite adverse consequences. It is considered a brain disorder because it involves functional changes to brain circuits involved in reward, stress, and self-control. Those changes may last a long time after a person has stopped taking drugs. Fine. So if we take this definition, we say, okay, that makes sense. That's a drug addict. If you put the word alcohol in there instead of drug, okay, that's an alcoholic. But the truth is, if you put in any other of our own vices into this sentence, we are all kind of addicts, right? So let's read this again. Addiction is defined as a chronic relapsing disorder characterized by compulsive coffee drinking, seeking and use despite adverse consequences, right? So we drink a lot of coffee even though it's really, really bad for us to have lots of it. What about food? Addiction is defined as a chronic relapsing disorder characterized by compulsive food seeking and use despite adverse consequences, right? Regardless of our weight, regardless of our health, do we keep intaking food? What about phone usage? What about texting while driving? What about talking on the phone while driving? What about technology in general? All of these vices that we have in our lives, which we probably would more often than not say, okay, it's not so bad, it's not the end of the world. Really, we are intaking these things, we are making use of so many things, and there are many negative consequences to it. And if we look at the black and white definition of addiction, and we look at the way we use a lot of things in our lives that probably don't always have positive influences on us, we are addicted to tons of things. Sin maybe being right up there. And again, not that we're bad people, not that we're sinners, but that we happen to sin a lot according to the black and white definition of what a sin is, and according to the black and white definition of what addiction is and what it's all about. Now, how does someone get addicted to something in the first place? So before this evening, you might have said, well, we all know how someone gets addicted. Or maybe they have a rough childhood, they have a rough life, they fall in with the wrong crowd, they have some negative influences on them, and bada bing, bada boom, before you know it, they're a crackhead, or they're living in an alley somewhere, and experiencing, and you know, shooting up every few hours. That's not true. The truth is, the way that we define addiction and how a person becomes an addict is much, much simpler, and it explains how even any of us, and likely all of us, are susceptible to becoming addicts in some way, shape, or form. There is an incredible scholar out there by the name of Judson Brewer. He's dotted all of his I's and crossed all of his T's in terms of fancy schools. He went to Harvard, he went to Yale, he went to Princeton, I think all the top schools. And he has a lot of great articles and TED Talks and books out there. We'll quote a few of them this evening. In source number two, I quote an incredible book of his. I highly recommend it. I'm not fully through it, but I've read a good part of it, and really is just an amazing book. The title is The Craving Mind. And here he explains how every single person can so easily get hooked on something. Take a look at source number two, and again, there are three boxes, one, two, and three, so follow along with me. He says as follows: when we get hooked on the latest video game on our phone, or our favorite flavor of Ben & Jerry's ice cream, we are tapping into one of the most evolutionary, conserved learning process is currently known to science, one shared among countless species and dating back to the most basic nervous systems known to man. This reward-based learning process basically goes like this. We see some food that looks good. Our brain says, calories, survival. And we eat the food. We taste it. It tastes good. And especially when we eat sugar, our bodies send a signal to our brains. Remember what you're eating and where you found it. We lay down this memory based on experience and location, and we learn to repeat the process the next time. See food, eat food, feel good. Repeat. Trigger behavior reward. every single time we do something that we enjoy, our body makes a mental note of that, our mind makes a mental note of that, and we are able to take that with us for the rest of our lives. After a while, our creative brain tells us, hey, you can use this for more than remembering where food is, right? So not just about survival, but you can also use this in other contexts, our mind tells us. The next time you feel bad, why don't you try eating something good so that you will feel better? We thank our brains for that great idea. Try it and quickly learn that if we eat ice cream or chocolate when we are mad or sad, we do feel better. It's the same learning process, just a different trigger. Instead of hunger, box number two, instead of a hunger signal coming from our stomachs, this emotional signal, feeling sad, triggers the urge to eat. Or maybe in our teenage years, we saw the rebel kids smoking outside school and looking cool. And we thought, hey, I want to be like them. And so we started smoking. See cool, smoke to be cool, feel good. Repeat. Trigger, behavior, reward. And each time we perform the behavior, we reinforce the brain pathway, which says, great, do it again. So we do, and it becomes a habit loop. Later, feeling stressed out, triggers that urge to eat something sweet or to smoke. Now, with the same brain mechanisms, we have gone from learning to survive to literally killing ourselves with these habits. Obesity and smoking are among the leading preventable causes of morbidity and mortality in the world. Right? So what a crazy idea. We have this deep mechanism in our mind that HaKadosh Baruch Hu created us with, an ability to survive in the world. Our mind tracks and keeps track of all of that which we need to keep our bodies healthy, but we are also able to manipulate that same koach to make our minds do things that are not always the best thing. We become addicted to lots of things that are not good for us. And to show you just a small example of what this is all about, take a look at the diagram on the very on the top of the very next page. It just explains it very simply. I don't know who here is into Twitter. I'm not a person personally into Twitter, but there are a lot of people into Twitter these days. So whether you are or you aren't, just insert whatever your vice is into this this diagram. So first we have trigger, right? You think of something funny, something smart, something, you want to make sure the world knows that you thought of this. Then you have a positive reinforcement for that, right? Because you know that when you post it, people will be all excited about it, and people will give you likes or hearts, or they'll retweet. Then you have a craving, right? You say, "This is, I really got to post this because I want to get those likes." And then you put the tweet out there, and then the tweeting feels good. And then again, you have trigger behavior reward. The trigger might be down the road that you have some sort of a stress or some sort of a fight with a loved one. Maybe you have a hard work day, right? You have the behavior. You know that when you do that thing, you know that that will feel good. You then do that thing, and then you get the reward. It feels great. Let's do that again sometime. And what's so amazing about this is that when you push this one step further and you realize that there are many things that we intake into our bodies or that we do with our bodies that can so negatively affect us, even though it's causing us a high, it's crazy when you take that to heart, the notion that we are damaging ourselves while simultaneously doing something that makes ourselves feel good. And this is something that I'm not really, I don't think I'm shocking anyone with this information, but we rarely spell this out black and white in this way. If you take a look at, we're going to skip source number four, but in source number four, it's basically a TED talk from that same individual, Judson Brewer, where he more or less says what we just read in source number two. But now, go forward and take a look at source number five. Because I think this is probably the simplest example that all of us can relate to on some level. If I were to ask you, which I won't take a poll, because I don't want to know, but how many people in this Zoom room are, and how many people who are watching this or listening to this, are individuals who maybe they don't identify as driving while texting people, but they have every now and again looked at their phone while driving. Maybe they saw, they got a ding, they got a chime, and they looked at their phone for a second, or they spoke on their phone while driving. The statistics are crazy. 75%, that's 3 out of every 4 people, will do some form of texting while driving, whether that's chronic texting or the occasional text. It's crazy because it's so dangerous. Take a look at source number 5. If if the ring, beep, or buzz of your cell phone triggers an intense urge to respond, and you find yourself reaching for the phone even when you're driving, you're not alone. A new survey commissioned by AT&T and Dr. David Greenfield, founder of the Center for Internet and Technology Addiction, he's a professor at the University of Connecticut, found that twice as many people as self-reported cell phone addiction are showing compulsive phone behaviors, with 3 in 4 people admitting to at least glancing at their phones while behind the wheel. We compulsively check our phones because every time we get an update through text, email, or social media, we experience an elevation of dopamine, which is a neurochemical in the brain that makes us feel happy, says Dr. Greenfield. If that desire for a dopamine fix leads us to check our phones while driving, a simple text can turn deadly. What it turns out is that many people are texting while driving, using their phone while driving. They know. You can ask this person, is it a good idea to look at your phone while driving and take your eyes off the road when anything could happen in any split second? No, every logical person understands that that's a horrible idea. And I imagine if you ask all 75% of the population if this is a good idea, probably 70 to 75% of them will tell you it's such a stupid thing to do. But still, they do it anyways. That's crazy. It's so illogical. Why would they do it? Because it feels good. And if it feels good when you do it, you get an excitement, you get a rush, however big or small, when you look at your phone, when you see you got a text, and you see you got a notification, even if it's some silly notification like someone challenged you in Candy Crush, something really small and stupid, since you feel that form of connection with your phone, even though it's dangerous, you will still go ahead and check it, even though this could lead to you getting into a car accident. 75% of the population is like that. And there is so many other areas where we can fill in that same blank and give similar statistics. How much percentage of the population is addicted to X, Y, or Z that negatively impacts them? They know it will likely end up killing them, but still, they do it anyways. Really, that's what addiction is all about. It's absolute insanity. And we are all crazy in one way, shape, or form. If you take a look at source number 6, it's from an incredible book by a lot of incredible books, at least according to my opinion, that I'm going to quote for you this evening. So one of them is called Addictive Thinking by Rabbi Dr. Abraham Twersky Zatzal. Here is a great quote. He says, Alan, a recovering alcoholic, was oblivious to the effects of his drinking in spite of what people said to him. Since he drank only beer, he was certain he did not have an alcohol problem. Eventually, Alan became physically sick and could no longer deny that something was wrong. He concluded that by drinking half a case of beer daily, he was consuming too much fluid, so he switched to scotch and soda. When the physical symptoms got worse, he faulted the soda and switched to whiskey and water. As the symptoms got even worse, he eliminated the water. Right? Only what a crazy idea. This person can't logically understand that the alcohol is negatively affecting his body. I'm sure if you gave this individual this exact study, but you changed the name, you said this was someone else, he'd say, what an idiot, he should have just stopped drinking alcohol. But when we do something, even though it could impact us negatively, if it makes us feel good, which is one of the most primal aspects of our mind that HaKadosh Baruch Hu created us with, then it can be a very dangerous turn of events, because we will evidently turn to negative things that can harm us if it makes us feel good in that moment. Then I have another case study over here in source number 7. Feel free to take a look on your own time as well, also from Rabbi Twersky, in which he gives another example of a heroin addict who logically knew that what she was doing to herself, to her body, was a horrible thing to do, but she did it anyways. But objectively, she knew it was terrible, but she couldn't stop herself. It only makes sense when you realize how when something can make you feel good, you'll go for it, even if you know it's not wise in many ways and circumstances that are very, very dangerous. But this is evidently how our minds work. We'll naturally respond to things that make us feel good, even to the extent of doing it when it might be harmful. And here lies our segue into part number 2. Are we addicted to sin? Because with that point made, with everything we've said thus far, it makes you wonder, are we addicted to the notion of committing averos? And what do Chazal have to say about this, right? Did our rabbis understand that we have this need to violate averos, that God created us in such a way that we have free will, such that 50% of the time we are likely committing sins? And is this something to be concerned about? Is this normal? Is this natural? Is there anything that we can do to stop this? what do our rabbis ultimately have to say about the notion and the connection between sin and addiction? And I'd like to start with a statement from Rav Dessler that really frames the conversation in a critical way. If you take a look at source number 8, Rav Dessler says in his Michtav Me'Eliyahu that the seduction of the Yetzer Hara extends so far that we believe its desire to be our desire. We never comprehend it as claiming you need, but rather I need, right? No one ever says, we all say, I need to violate X, Y, and Z, right? We probably don't frame it to ourselves, I need to violate, but we say, I need to do X, Y, or Z, which may or may not be a sin. And we never say that, we never hear that as advice being given to us, even though that is technically how we believe the mechanism works. We believe that God created this Yetzer Hara that tells us, that gives us ideas to do bad things, and we then do those bad things, right? Imagine the little devil sitting on the corner of your left shoulder, telling you bad things to do. That's technically how we believe it works, but we never hear, you should go do this. We hear, I need to go do this. And the reason why that is, or at least the result of that, is that we have this feeling that the Yetzer Hara is ingrained so deeply within us. But says Rav Dessler, don't ever forget, it's not you with those urges, it's the Yetzer Hara pushing you and making you think that you want to violate these terrible things. And that's why at the outset we have to understand that just like you used to have the Marlboro Man commercials with this cool looking cowboy and these cool individuals who were smoking, and there are so many things that you could fill in that blank as well of dangerous and negative things that we can intake into our bodies that are sold just like that to make it feel cool and to make it exciting. So too, when it comes to sin, Chazal were sensitive to this fact. They realized that we are sold it in such a way that it's made clear to us that we're going to be cool, we're going to feel great if we do X, Y, and Z. But ultimately, it's not me that the ideas come from, it's the Yetzer Hara that this is all coming from. And it's unbelievable if you take a look at source number 9, the Gemara in Masechah Sota says that what will cause a person to sin, or not what will cause, but when a person sins, what is that equivalent to? And Chazal tell us, "Ein Adam Over Avera, Ela Imkein Nichnas Bo Ruach Shtus." The only way that anyone can ever sin, again, that means maybe 50% of the time for us, the only way that a person can sin is if a spirit of insanity comes into their minds. That sounds a lot like what we just said addiction is. Addiction is when you do something negative that has adverse consequences, but you can't stop yourself. And that's exactly what sin is as well. You are going ahead and doing this action, you know you shouldn't do it. Come on, you know you shouldn't speak badly about that person. You know you maybe shouldn't eat something that's not so good. Maybe you shouldn't look at something. Or maybe there's so many things that we do. But nonetheless, we get this ruach shtus, and evidently 50% of that time we get some sort of spirit of insanity that comes into our minds. And this is so true that says the Gemara in Kedushin in source number 10, kevan sha'avar adam avira, when a person violates an avira, vishinaba, and they do it over and over again, hutralo, it becomes permissible to him. When a person does a sin over and over again, he does it so many times that this is like, it's not even a question. Of course I can do it, it's totally permissible. Says the Gemara, hutralo salkatetach, what do you mean? If he does it, it becomes permissible to him? Of course, if it's prohibited at the first time, certainly by the 60th time he does it, it's going to be prohibited. Says the Gemara, elena'aseis lokeheter, in his mind it's going to feel permissible. The first time that we all picked up our phone and texted while driving, we're like, I don't know if I should do this. I can't. I'm not looking at the cars in front of me. This probably isn't the best idea. Now, when a person picks up their phone, looks at their phone, this is the world we live in. Everyone looks at their phone. One time, I got to tell you this story. Unbelievable story. I was taking an Uber one time. My family and I were going to the airport, and here was this Uber driver. So, I can't remember. I think it was just Leora at that point. So it was Rina and Leora. They were in the back seat, and it was me sitting in the front seat. And the Uber driver, he had, I think, two or three phones set up. And you think, wow, that's a good Uber driver. He's trying to make sure all the routes are good. No. He had one phone set up where he was watching TV while he was driving. He had Netflix streaming over here. He had another phone where he was checking his email. And he had a third phone with a map. What a great guy. He was checking the map while he was watching TV and checking his email. And he was driving us in the car with me and my little child in the back. It's unbelievable. Who does things like that? But when you frame it, And just a reminder, if you can mute yourself, please. When you frame it that we are addicted to it and we just can't help ourselves, we know it's not a good idea, but we can't stop it. So things like that, crazy things like that could happen. And the Gemara in source number 11 as well, the Gemara in Sukkah, Anun Beis Amar Aleph, says, Amar Rav Asi, Yetzer Hara Batchila Dome Lechut Shel Buchya. Originally, when we do a sin, when we do something negative for the first time, we're not really tied to it so deeply. It's like if we are tied to it in any way, it's like a spider web. That's how strong the rope is. But ulavasof dome kaavosos haagala. When we do the sin over and over again, it doesn't feel like we're tied to the sin with a spider web, but rather like ropes on a wagon, really strong ropes. Because after we do a sin or we do something negative, anything that we're addicted to, we do it over and over again. It doesn't feel weird. It's just second practice. It's second nature. This is what we do, and we can't stop because this is who we are already.
What is up around me?
With that, we have to wonder, what is the general Torah perspective on addiction, right? So we just showed that there are many sources that allude to how easy it is for us to fall into this downward spiral of consistently doing things that are maybe not good for us. But so if that's how we're created, what are we supposed to do? That is what it is. Or does the Torah have a lot to say of how we can cure ourselves from that? And of course the Torah has a lot to say on this. Take a look at source number 12, a fascinating brief question and answer that was asked to a great Rav in the 20th century by the name of Rabbi Ben Sion Mutsafi. He was a Sfardi Rav in Mekuba living in Yerushalayim in the 1900s. And he was asked as follows. And we're going to have a lot of questions now, just a trigger warning. We have a lot of questions coming up about smoking marijuana. If you did it in the past, okay, but maybe you shouldn't do it in the future, as you'll see in a second. He was asked as follows: Ma da'as ha-Torah legabi ishon sanim kalim? Can I smoke weed, Rabbi? Is that permissible? The second line, he says, Kol ma'achal shtia and chomer sheha'adam mismaker alav usher. He says anything that can cause an addiction to form in someone is prohibited to partake of. So fine, so weed and smoking, all these things that we in our enlightened 2021 lives understand probably are not so good for you, most of us probably would agree with that you shouldn't be touching these things. What about other things like coffee or maybe like chocolate or maybe some other good foods or some good drinks out there that we all have, of course, in moderation? But maybe we're also a little bit addicted to some of these things that we enjoy. Are those things also prohibited? Or is it just the things that we know are bad? And what about trying to define why it is bad to smoke, why it is bad to use recreational marijuana or things like that, if it is, but it's not bad to be addicted to other substances like caffeine or like different foods? Why is one thing worse than the other? And of course, I'm not trying to say that there are no studies and no facts on the ground that explain why smoking, for example, is so bad for an individual, but there are a lot of things that are bad for people. Yet we sort of make these like invisible walls in between things, that it's totally okay to say that smoking is bad for you, but to say that certain foods, right, 5,000 calorie chocolate bars, that's, or a 5,000 calorie frappuccino in Starbucks, whatever it is, that's legal, that's okay. It's amazing how we sort of make these invisible lines for ourselves. But anyways, that was the opinion of Rabbi Mutsafi, that anything that would cause an addiction should similarly be prohibited for you to partake of ever. And the Gemara was very sensitive to this as well. Take a look at source number 13, the Gemara in Pesachim on Kuf Yud Gimel Amar Alf. Amarle Rav Lechia Brei. Rav says to his son, La Tishti Sama. Evidently, there were some medicines back in the day that were like elixirs. And if you would drink too much of it, even a little bit of it, you might become addicted to it. And so he says, don't drink this. I don't care what it does for you, don't drink it. You know why? Because you become addicted to it. Says Rashi in source number 14, take a look at the English. Do not drink medicines or elixirs. Do not accustom yourself to drink potions, for you will establish a pattern of it, and your heart will crave it, and you will squander your money. That's literally what an addiction is. If you continue after this item, it won't be good for you, because not only will it be dangerous for you, your life, maybe, but it will also be dangerous for your bank account. It will be dangerous for your family. You won't have You won't have a livelihood to support your family because you'll constantly be running after these items. And if you take a look at source number 15 as well, Rav Moshe Feinstein in his Igros Moshe was asked the question of, can a person be smoking a marijuana ever? So if you take a look at the third paragraph there in English, he says, he gives many reasons why it's prohibited to smoke marijuana, but he says, furthermore, he is creating within himself a very strong desire, an addiction, which is much stronger than the desire to eat, which are necessary for a person to live. What he does over here is something fascinating. He says, let's understand why we make these invisible walls. Why is smoking worse than being addicted to coffee or any other edible item that we use or partake of in our lives? Very simple. We don't need to smoke. We don't need to be intoxicating ourselves with anything in that category of substance usage. But food, we need to eat to live. And so true, we probably should limit our intake more often than not. And we probably should not be drinking as much coffee or doing whatever as much as we're doing in the food category. But that invisible line is a clear one, because one we can live without of, one we cannot live without of, without. So just to be aware of that. So he says that anything that will create within ourselves a strong addiction, a strong desire, push it away. Howie? Even when I'm the only one in shul. Thank you. So that's what Rav Moshe Feinstein says. When it comes to anything that will cause addiction that's not necessary for our lives, don't even bother with it. And so to the Rambam in source number 16. The Rambam is probably one of the strongest Rishonim out there in terms of his feelings on drinking. He has many areas in his writings where he says how bad it is. But here's what he writes. It's a pretty weighed comment that he makes in his Mishneh Torah in Hilchos Deos in Halacha in Perek Hey Halacha Gimel. He says, let's just read the English. When the wise drinks wine, he partakes only enough to moisten the food in his bowels. Right? Is wine good for you? Is wine bad for you? I feel like every other day there's an article that says wine is good for you. Then the next day the wine is bad for you. Well, actually, a lot of wine. Right. Well, so whatever it is, evidently back in his day, the scientific understanding was that a little wine could be good for you because it could help your digestive system a little bit. But he says as follows, whosoever intoxicates himself is a sinner, contemptible, and brings about the loss of his wisdom. If he intoxicates himself in the presence of the uncivilized, behold, this one blasphemed the name, right, God. It is forbidden to drink wine at noon, even a small quantity, save it to be included in the meal, for drink, which is part of the meal, is not intoxicating. However, no warning is needed, save from wine after meals. It's totally usher to ever think that you should intoxicate yourself, that you should overindulge yourself in anything. Because if you do that, the point where you lose control is the point where you are clearly going outside of the framework of what the Torah really wants for us. And in source number 17, we have a similar idea as well. Rabbi Adin Steinsaltz was quoted in this book, On the Road with Rabbi Steinsaltz. And here is a statement from Rabbi Steinsaltz Zatzal. He says, if you are the master of anything in your lives, fine. But if you are the slave, then you are in trouble no matter what you are the slave of, whether it be coffee, exercise, or Torah study. Meaning, if you are the one who is in control with any substance, food, drink, action, activity, if you are in control, you're making these decisions, and you're not just lying to yourself, but you're actually making these decisions, then great, says Rabbi Steinsaltz. But the moment you are involved in something that you are not in control of, but it is in control of you, that's when you should no longer be involved in that substance, because that's called an addiction, and we don't believe in addictions in the Torah. And this is why when we have in source number 18, the famous opening story, the first time in the Torah, when a person gets drunk, when Noach, after he gets out of the Teva, we're told very negatively about Noach, and there is a great deal of literature written on this. It says as follows, source number 18 in Perek, Tes, Psukim, Chaf through Chaf, Chet, he says, the pasuk says, Vayachal Noach ish adama, Vayitah kerem. The first thing Noach does after he gets off the boat, after the flood that lasted for months on end, he plants a vineyard. And what does he do? The first action after planting, obviously there had to be some time in between when he planted and when he drank, but we don't care what happened in between that, because it's as if immediately, vayeshtim in ayayin, he drank from the wine, vayishkar, and he became drunk. And the Torah goes on to say how he debased himself, but how he became like this horrible person. And the question is, how did that happen to him? Regardless of how that happened to him, which we'll speak about in just a few moments, the Torah clearly is not fond of this. Take a look at Rabbeinu Bachi in source number 19. Let's begin. It's like from like the last chunk paragraph. The words are, the Torah informed us. That's what it starts with. The Torah informed us of many problems that are apt to be caused by wine. If wine was even able to cause a righteous man, such as Noah, a man who had saved all mankind, to commit a sin by cursing his descendants. This whole paragraph is at least as much a warning to mankind as is the passage in Numbers chapter 6, which discusses that a Nazarite must abstain from wine and any grape product. Our sages in Sanhedrin note that the passage discussing wine contains the letter Vav 13 times, and he debased himself, and he planted, and he drank, and he got drunk, and he uncovered himself, and Chamsa, and he told, and Shame, and Yafet took the cover, and they placed, etc., etc. This is what Solomon had in mind when he said in Proverbs, who has woe, who has sorrow, who has contentions, who has quarrels, who has injuries without cause, who suffers from redness of his eyes, those who linger over wine. Solomon does not refer exclusively to wine, but he includes all other matters which are the objects of man's lusting after worldly pleasures, and which are addictive and become the cause of man's premature death in this world, and is losing his right to eternal life in the hereafter. So Noach is the paradigm of how negative, of how bad addiction is. And what Rabbeinu Bachya explains from Noach's actions is that it's not that wine is the only negative thing, is the only thing that the Torah would frown upon, but any substance that would lead us astray from the spirit of what the Torah wants from us, that's an addiction, and we have to run as fast as we can in the other direction. And similarly, the Mesilas Yesharim in source number 20 says, similar to what we just read from Rabbi Steinsaltz, he says, one who habituates himself in these practices is not master over himself to do the opposite of these things when he wishes, for his will is already imprisoned in the prison of habit, which has become second nature to him. And finally, and we'll conclude this section with the very famous Ramban in source number 21 on the Pasuk in Parshas Kedoshim, Perek Yotes, Pasuk Beis, and Sefer Vayikra, that there is a notion that we have to be Kedoshim, we have to be holy. What does it mean we have to be holy? And the Ramban very famously explains, being holy means that one has the capacity and the ability to be a Navel Bershut HaTorah. Someone has the ability to follow every single one of the 613 commandments, but still they could be a Menuvel. And we unfortunately know people like this. They are the frumis, they do everything. I don't even mean the people who are just main on them lamakon people. I mean people who are kind to others, people who are very good at all the mitzvos. But still, these people are a little bit, something isn't right. And that might be a person that we would consider a menuvel bershus haTorah. You are dotting all your I's, you are crossing all your T's, but something is still off. We can follow all 613 commandments without following the 614th commandment, which might be the notion that we cannot ever be drawn, be stuck, be tied to something so strongly and so deeply, because if we are, whether it is alcohol, whether it is drugs, or whether it is sin, or whether it is food, or whether it is technology, there is something wrong with our relationship with that. We cannot have any other master in this world other than HaKadosh Baruch Hu himself. But once we are enslaved to any of the vices in our lives, then we need to do as much as we can to break that connection. And that's not to say that you just break the connection, because we all have it. Every single person on the face of the earth has an addictive connection, an addictive relationship with something that they probably should not have. And the reason why I know that is because you wouldn't be human if you didn't. But our goal in this world, is to try to break these addictions, to try to break these connections that are not healthy for us as much as possible. And with that, we get to our final part of the shiur for this evening. Part number three, understanding addiction and how to quote-unquote cure it. And the reason why I put it in quotes is because, as we'll see, one never really cures addiction, but we have to understand, what is the source of it? Where does it come from? Right? And so I want to quote for you an incredible TED Talk that just a part of it, for a transcript of it, that I just heard it the other day, and it literally changed my life in terms of his perspective of what addiction actually has always been defined for us, but what it actually is in reality. Take a look at source number 22, and I have to apologize. I have no idea how to pronounce this guy's name. I think it's like Johan Hari, but he's like British. I don't know. Okay, so take a look at source number 2. Here's what he said in this TED Talk. And if you want the full TED Talk, please message me afterwards. I'll send you the link. He said as follows. And when I learned this, it seemed so weird to me, so contrary to everything I'd been told, everything I thought I knew. I just thought it couldn't be right, until I met a man called Bruce Alexander. He's a professor of psychology in Vancouver who carried out an incredible experiment I think really helps us to understand this issue. Professor Alexander explained to me the idea of addiction we've all got in our heads. That story comes partly from a series of experiments that were done earlier in the 20th century. They're really simple. You can do them tonight at home if you feel a little sadistic. You get a rat and you put it in a cage and you give it two water bottles. One is just water and the other is water laced with either heroin or cocaine. If you do that, the rat will almost always prefer the drug, water, and almost always kill itself quite quickly. So there you go, right? That's how we think it works. In the 70s, Professor Alexander comes along and he looks at this experiment and he noticed something. He said, we're putting the rat in an empty cage. It's got nothing to do except use these drugs. Let's try something different. So Professor Alexander built a cage that he called Rat Park, which is basically heaven for rats. They've got loads of cheese, they've got loads of colored balls, they've got loads of tunnels. Crucially, they've got loads of friends. They can have loads, okay, because whatever. And they've got both the water bottles, the normal water, and the drugged water. But here's the fascinating thing. In Rat Park, they don't like the drug water. They almost never use it. None of them ever use it compulsively. None of them ever overdosed. You go from almost 100% overdose when they're isolated to 0% overdose when they have happy and connected lives. Now, when he first saw this, Professor Alexander thought, maybe this is just a thing about rats. They're quite different to us. Maybe not as different as we'd like. But you know, but unfortunately, there was a human experiment into the exact same principle happening at the exact same time. It was called the Vietnam War. In Vietnam, 20% of all American troops were using loads of heroin. And if you look at the news reports from the time, they were really worried because they thought, my God, we're going to have hundreds of thousands of junkies on the streets of the United States when the war ends. It made total sense. Now, those soldiers who were using loads of heroin were followed home. The Archives of General Psychiatry did a really detailed study. And what happened to them? It turns out they didn't go to rehab. They didn't go into withdrawal. 95% of them just stopped. Now, if you believe the story about chemical hooks, that makes absolutely no sense. But Professor Alexander began to think there might be a different story about addiction. He said, what if addiction isn't about your chemical hooks? What if addiction is about your cage? What if addiction is an adaptation to your environment? Looking at this, there was another professor called Peter Cohen in the Netherlands who said, maybe we shouldn't even call it addiction. Maybe we should call it bonding. Human beings have a natural and innate need to bond. And when we're happy and healthy, we'll bond and connect with each other. But if you can't do that because you're traumatized or isolated or beaten down by life, you will bond with something that will give you some sense of relief. Now that might be gambling, that might be pornography, that might be cocaine, that might be cannabis, but you will bond and connect with something because that's our nature. That's what we want as human beings. And we'll read just one more paragraph, but it goes on. He's so good. And at first, I found this quite a difficult thing to get my head around. But one way that helped me to think about it is, I can see I've got over by my seat a bottle of water, right? I'm looking at lots of you. This is him speaking to the crowd. And lots of you have bottles of water with you. Forget the drugs. Forget the drug war. Totally legally, all of those bottles of water could be bottles of vodka, right? We could all be getting drunk. Okay. But we're not. Now, because you've been able to afford the approximately gazillion pounds that it costs to get into a TED Talk, I'm guessing you guys could afford to be drinking vodka for the next 6 months. You wouldn't end up homeless. You're not going to do that. And the reason you're not going to do that is not because anyone's stopping you. It's because you've got bonds and connections that you want to be present for. You've got work you love. You've got people you love. You've got healthy relationships. And a core part of addiction, I came to think and I believe the evidence suggests, is about not being able to bear to be present in your life. And if you skip to the very last line of that of the source, he says the opposite of addiction is not sobriety. The opposite of addiction is connection. And if you take a look at source number 23, I don't know a more surefire way to explain this than by looking at the drug overdose deaths from 1999 to 2019. These numbers are crazy. You know, everyone's talking about how the COVID pandemic has caused the greatest epidemic of drug overdoses. And we'll get to that in just a second. Don't worry. But if you look from 1999, what the drug overdose rate was in 1999 to 2019, it multiplied by, eight or nine fold. It went from less than 20,000 to 70,000 a year. And now, through the COVID pandemic, it's 90,000 or something a year. You want to hear something really crazy, though? You want to know what the drug overdose death rate was from the 60s, the end of the 60s to the early 90s? It ranged an average from 2 to 5,000 people every single year. That means for most of history that this has been tracked for us, we know that usually somewhere between 2 and 5,000 people would die from a drug overdose every single year. Now the number is almost 100,000 people a year, which doesn't make any sense when you think about it. How do we have a society that is so connected, that is so in touch with one another, that I can see what all of my 15,000 friends are doing at any second of any day if I just go on my phone and I see everyone's lives? Why is everyone dying from drug overdoses? And this is just drugs. What about alcohol? What about anything else? What about texting and driving? Why are these things killing us? Why are we allowing these things to kill us? And the answer seems to be that we as a society, as much as we have become more connected, it's an illusion. We're not more connected to one another. We are more isolated than ever before. And therefore, this has raised the level of addiction, of drugs, of alcohol, but even of other substances like using our phones and like eating food and stress eating and all of the like. So the easy way to solve this problem is by creating more connection between people, strengthening our community. But I would argue that we need to be even more simple, even more basic than that. We have to go back to much more fundamental ideas before we can even talk about the notion of creating stronger connections between people. By the way, before we even get there, let's look at the COVID pandemic for a second. Why has drug overdose been so bad during the COVID pandemic? Because of the isolation. But it's not something that just happened out of nowhere. It's not like we went from 5,000 deaths a year of drug overdose to 100,000. We went from 70 to 90. A big leap in 20,000 people that probably didn't have to die, but it was from 5,000 20 years ago or 25 years ago to 100,000 now, 25 years later. It's because as connected as we think we are, that is an illusion. We are more isolated than ever before. And the way to cure that is to create connection. But before we create connection, I'd like to posit that the truth is that there are actually three steps. There are three things that we have to do. The last will be ultimately creating community and being strengthened by those around us. But the first two have nothing to do with community. The first two have everything to do with ourselves. The first step is something that's called mindfulness. And that sounds like a very woke thing. That's what all the kids are doing these days, mindfulness. But I would like to introduce it to you. For those of you who are aware of it, who know what it is, amazing. For those of you who don't know what it is, it's an incredible thing that I would argue is an ikara, fundamental of what the Torah wants us to be doing with our lives on a daily basis. Take a look at source number 24. This guy, our friend Judson Brewer again, he says as follows. He says, now the prefrontal cortex, that youngest part of our brain from an evolutionary perspective, it understands on an intellectual level that we shouldn't smoke. And it tries its hardest to help us change our behavior, to help us stop smoking, to help us stop eating that second, that third, that fourth cookie. We call this cognitive control. We're using cognition to control our behavior. Unfortunately, this is also the first part of our brain that goes offline when we get stressed out, which isn't that helpful. Now, we can all relate to this in our own experience. We're much more likely to do things like yell at our spouse, our kids, when we're stressed out or tired, even though we know it's not going to be helpful. We just can't help ourselves. When the prefrontal cortex goes offline, we fall back into our old habits, which is why this disenchantment is so important. Seeing what we get from our habits helps us understand them at a deeper level, to know it in our bones so we don't have to force ourselves to hold back or restrain ourselves from behavior. We're just less interested in doing it in the first place. And this is what mindfulness is all about. Seeing really clearly what we get when we get caught up in our behaviors, becoming disenchanted on a visceral level, and from this disenchanted stance, naturally letting go. This isn't to say that poof, magically, we quit smoking, but over time, as we learn to see more and more clearly the results of our actions, we let go of old habits and form new ones. And he goes on, feel free to read the rest on your own, he goes on to explain that you have a smoker who naturally can quit smoking after enough time, energy, and hard work by using mindfulness itself. How? No other nicotine patches, no nicotine gum, but just simply understanding, being mindful of where they are in the present. What that means is the next time you take a cigarette, the smoker, you take a puff, and you have to just try to understand where you are in that very moment. Close your eyes, understand what's happening, why is this happening, and immediately you'll be drawn to a different reality. You'll be catapulted to not some fake reality, but the realest reality you ever felt. The first time, perhaps, that you will actually be listening to yourself. And therefore, whenever any of us finds ourselves encountering something that maybe we should not be doing, maybe something that we turn to when we get stressed out, maybe sinning, maybe eating, maybe technology, maybe texting while driving, whatever it is, stop yourself for a moment. Take a deep breath. Close your eyes unless you're driving. Keep your eyes open if you're driving. And think to yourself, why am I doing this? And if you can focus on your own emotional experience in that singular moment, then you can lead yourself perhaps down a path of recovery from some of the most difficult connections and addictions that we have in our own lives. He even goes on to say, he brings data to prove this, that twice as many people are able to do something like quit smoking using mindfulness than they are using other of the more classic detoxification methods. So mindfulness is critical. But then the obvious question is, does Judaism have anything to say about mindfulness, right? You'd want Judaism to have something to say about this if I'm telling you that it's so fundamental to life. Take a look at source number 5. There are a number of books that have come out really only in recent, in the past 5 years. But there's one book that I own that I have never read through it fully, but you know, the first few pages are great, and you'll see the first few pages here. Take a look at source number 25. It's a book called Living in the Presence, A Jewish Mindfulness Guide for Everyday Life, written by someone named Ben Epp. And he writes as follows. Jewish mysticism teaches that the Hebrew language isn't merely a mode of communication, an expression commonly agreed upon as a social convention, but rather should be viewed as the building blocks of the entire cosmos. The Hebrew language is unique in that it not only serves to describe an object, but also conveys the essence of what is being transmitted. The word yishuv means settlement, and da'at may be translated as knowledge or awareness. Thus, a settled awareness, which connotes the tranquility most people have come to associate with this term. But at its root, the word da'at has a more profound meaning. The mystics explain that the Torah's first usage of a word serves as its archetype, in the light of which all of its subsequent usages should be viewed. The first time that da'at is used in the Torah is in the verse Adam knew his wife Chava. Adam knew his wife not merely cognitively, but in the most intimate sense. Da'at thus indicates fusion, connection, and unification. All other terms used to translate da'at are derivations of this original meaning. The only way to know something is to unite and fully connect with it. Thus, Yishuv HaDa'at has a much more profound import than peace of mind. It means settling into present moment awareness. Yishuv HaDa'at becomes not only the description of a state of mind, but the means to cultivate a state of being. The key to being fully alive and at peace is to be settled in and connected to whatever is happening in one's life, both internally and externally. Peace of mind can only come from a settled mind that is attached to and knows not merely cerebrally, but viscerally whatever is happening here and now. And he goes on to essentially explain that Judaism is the biggest supporter of mindfulness and recognizing that the notion of kavana, of having the right intent when we do all the mitzvos that we do, it's all about mindfulness. It's all about understanding the here and now. How am I feeling? How am I experiencing? I am going to do a commandment that the master of the universe commanded me in doing. Am I about to do an avera? I am about to violate an avera that the master of the universe has given me. When you do something like that, when you frame it like that for yourselves, odds are more often than not, you'll probably consider stepping away from whatever it is you're about to do. The first step to curing ourselves, to breaking this addiction, is mindfulness. And I encourage everyone to consider trying to do that at least 15 seconds to a minute every single day with one action, and I really believe it will change your lives. The second step is when we change our habit, we are able to change our identity. In another beautiful book written by someone named James Clear, he talks about Atomic Habits. That's the name of the book. And I'm not going to read it inside because there's a lot here. But basically, what he says is as follows. No one ever made a change in their lives by going from 0 to 60 in 10 seconds. But if you make small, gradual changes, if you make small shifts every so often, you will ultimately be able to look back on yourself a year later, 2 years later, 6, 10 years later, whatever it is, a totally different than a totally changed person. If you, for example, let's say you are someone who you know that you should be davening, you know that you should be better about davening, but you aren't so good about including certain prayers, or you say the bare minimum, or whatever it is. I challenge you, insert one prayer. If you don't daven at all now, if you're someone who is not a quote-unquote davener, say one paragraph of prayer every single day. In 15 years from now, and you've added every single year one little paragraph of prayer, you will be so deeply connected in a way that you never thought possible. Don't try to go from 0 to 60 overnight. Go from 0 to 60 over a lifetime. And if you can do that, then you can make real changes in your life and in everything that you are. And this is exactly what we believe in Judaism as well. If you take a look at source number 7, it's the Kitzur Shulchan Aruch. In his opening explanation of some of the daily laws, he says, "V'hamargil es atzmo baderech hazeh." If you want to change how you do things, if you want to manage to become a different individual, you have to do something 4 or 5 times. You have to habituate yourself, but slowly. And if you can habituate yourself to something, and you do it slowly and in a measured sense, then you can accomplish, you can change, you can do anything you want, you can break yourself from the shackles of any addictions that you might have. But after we do all that, after we are mindful and we know who we are, we understand where we're coming from a little bit better. And we've done everything we can to work on ourselves to affect and impact and change our habits to whatever extent that we're able to do. The final step ultimately is community. If you take a look at source number 28, the Rambam and his Hilchos Deos, take a look at the English. He says it's a natural tendency of man to be influenced in his ideas and conduct by his fellows and associates, and to follow the usage of the people of his state. If you ever think about it, the notion of peer pressure, the notion of me just following the crowd of doing what others around me are doing, what a crazy idea. Why do we work like that? But if you put it in the context of everything that we've seen until now, it makes perfect sense. Everything in life is all about connection. We want to be connected to all of those around us. If all of those around us are doing bad things, we will do bad things. Not because I'm a bad person, but because perhaps I made bad connections with the bad kind of people. But if we are able to lift ourselves up as a community at once and simultaneously all strive to make those positive changes, those positive commitments, impact ourselves in those small yet positive gradual changes, then we can maybe accomplish something that's very special. We can grow to new heights. We can become totally different people and a totally different community, perhaps. And to conclude, I want to share two pieces with you by the same author, an individual by the name of Rabbi Chase Taub. He's an incredible writer and just has a lot of amazing things to say out there. And I have to thank my mother. I think my mother's on this Zoom. And she's the one who told me about him in the first place. And the second source is actually from one of the books that she shared with me. And listen to what he has to say. First, source number 29, and source number 30, but take a look. There was an article in Moment magazine that asked many different rabbis from different denominations, what does the Torah teach us about addiction? Take a look at what Rabbi Taub has to say. He says as follows, Adam and Eve ate from the tree because they wanted knowledge. What they got was self-knowledge, not insight, but rather a crippling self-consciousness, the first sign of which was their sudden shame at being naked. Since that time, it has become ingrained in human nature to be uncomfortable in our own skin. Some of us feel that discomfort with self more intensely than others, but it is the universal curse of all humankind. 10 generations after creation, seeing a new world before him, Noah tried to reverse the paradigm and fight self-consciousness with self-obliteration. He planted a vineyard and got drunk. Noah was not out to have a good time. He was on a mission to blot out self-consciousness, and thus he drank until he fell asleep naked in his tent. He felt no shame because he felt nothing. This is the dilemma. The pain of self-awareness on the one extreme and the comfort of self-obliteration on the other. Neither is very promising. To become free, we must find a third option, which is self-transcendence, to rise above ego. As long as we do not have the tools to rise above ourselves, however, we'll do the next best thing and just destroy ourselves. Hence the decidedly choice terms for serious self-meditation, wasted, wrecked, trashed, right? Why do we use these words? Because that's what you are. Someone who's drunk, he's wasted, he's lost, he's trying to kill himself, he's trying to destroy himself. Contrary to popular misconception, addiction isn't a problem. Addiction is actually a solution. A vicious, brutal, devastating solution, but a solution nonetheless. And if that's all you've got to work with, then you will always come back to it, no matter what. That was the first source that I wanted to share with you. The second source, and source number 30, from Rabbi Taub's book called God of Our Understanding. It's about addiction and the Jewish perspective of addiction. Take a look at what he has to say. It's a great story that he tells. And again, thank you to my mom for sharing this source with me. He says as follows, I once had a double speaking engagement in a synagogue that also hosted a Jewish recovery program. From 7 to 8, I was the speaker at the regular synagogue function, and then I walked to the other side of the building and spoke to the addicts from 8 until 9. I spoke to the first group about some basic ideas of Jewish spirituality and how they apply to living a better life. After speaking to that group, I felt like a sales clerk whose client indulges him to give a long, elaborate pitch for an item that they both know the client isn't going to buy. Maybe it was me. Maybe I was off that night. Whatever the reason, I felt that most of the crowd really had no use for the ideas that I was trying to communicate. I headed down the hall to the other group and prepared myself to deliver what was essentially the same lecture that I had just given, only with some recovery language thrown in. When I got to the room full of addicts, I was suddenly struck with a wonderful feeling. I probably get the same vibe every time I speak to addicts, but this time, the constant having spoken to another group minutes earlier was immediate. I apologize, it's cut off a little bit. He says, go to the next paragraph. As I started talking, I found myself speaking about what Jung describes as the spiritual thirst of our being for wholeness, the union with God. Why do we yearn to be at one with God? I ask, what is it about that makes us feel uncomfortable as an entity apart from God? And I proceeded to explain what Chassidus, the mystical teachings of the Hasidic masters, says about the very nature of separate consciousness of the being a painful delusion, an error in thinking that must be rejected in favor of the absolute truth that we do not really have an existence that is independent from the all-encompassing, all-pervasive unity of all. I cannot claim that whatever. He goes on to quote himself, then go to the final box. Yet if we believe that the universe has a beginning, we must say that God started by taking nothing and making it into something. In so doing, God did not just change the form of nothing; he overrode its very essence. The very definition of nothing is that it does not exist. By forcing nothing to be something, God made nothing be the very opposite of what it really is. Now, when we form one something into another, it usually keeps the shape we put it in. A loaf of bread isn't going to disassemble itself back into flour and water. A plastic cup isn't going to revert to petroleum. Why? Because for flour and water to be bread, and for petroleum to be a plastic cup, is no imposition at all upon the essence of flour and water or petroleum. Their essence hasn't changed, only their form. When God turned nothing into something, he completely changed its essence. Every moment that nothing exists as a something is unnatural. Indeed, nothing would not even continue to be something unless it's constantly being forced to do so, which is why we say that creation is necessarily an ongoing process. At any rate, if you exist when you are a something, then you are a something. But that's only because God is creating you that way in that instant. Your essence is to be nothing, or should we say your true and natural state is to have no existence of your own, and to exist only as He exists within the totality and oneness of God. He goes on to explain, and I don't believe I have the full thing quoted here, but it's... I don't think I have the full thing here, but he goes on to explain that the people in that room, the second group, were so drawn to his talk, even though it was the same exact talk that he gave to the first group, when the first group was totally disengaged. They were like, okay, we get it, Rabbi, you're very spiritual, whatever, God is nice, whatever. But the second group of addicts, of recovering addicts, was enamored by what he had to say. And he explains that the reason why is because addicts naturally need God. That if you are connected to something because you're addicted to it, then the odds are that once you remove that addiction, that connection, you need to connect to something else. And this is exactly what we've been saying. Addiction is not needing alcohol. Addiction is bonding to something. Instead of bonding to alcohol, they'll bond to God. Instead of bonding to something negative, we need to find a way to remove those bonds and bond ourselves to something positive. And even though this is not exactly what Rabbi Taub said, what I would suggest is that in a way, as we've been saying for the entire shiur, we are all addicts. And just like addicts do like to connect to God, they need to connect to God, so too does each and every one of us. Every one of us has these vices in our lives that we are connected to, that some are negative, some are positive, some do good for us, but most of it probably may be bad for us. We have to find ways to be mindful, to try and understand how we are really hurting ourselves with many of the things that we are addicted to. Understand why it is that we're drawn to those things. Strive to change the habits that we have started, that we have laid out for ourselves, and find the community around us to help us all grow and be lifted up together in reshaping our addiction, that we're not running after negative vices or negative things, but that we're all running after the only connection that really matters, and that is a connection with the Almighty, a connection with the Ribono Shel Olam. For the remainder of the Aseres Yemei Tshuva, as we daven for salvation from the terrible state that the world is in right now, let us specifically ask for redemption for some of the bad habits and some of the bad patterns that we all started doing during or maybe even before this pandemic. So that when the dust settles, when this actually is really all over and we have removed ourselves from this unbelievable time, this won't have just been a traumatizing experience, but it will be an unbelievable time of growth. Hashem should bless us with the ability to be mindful, which is hard work, but it's well worth it. He should give us the ability to work on ourselves slowly but surely. And He should give us the ability to lift ourselves together up as a community. And to do as what the Rambam says in source number 31, and with this we'll conclude. The Rambam in his Mishnah Torah and his Hilchos Tshuva explains, Midarchei HaTshuva Liyos, what is Tshuva all about? Mishanesh Shemo. Klomar ani acher ve'ini osoha ish she'asa usana masim. When we do true teshuva, we become a different person, which is a little bit antithetical to everything that we've said thus far. If we are all addicted to sin, then we want to be that same person. We just want to change a little bit of who we are. We just want to remove the addiction from the negative things and put it on the positive things. But what I would suggest, therefore, is what the Rambam is saying, is not that we are not that person anymore, but that we have grown so much. We have altered the trajectory and the course of our lives so intensely that we are not even recognizable. True, it's still Dove Winston. It's still Ploni Almoni. It's still so-and-so. But it's almost as if we're not recognizable anymore because we have overcome so much. We've reached unthinkable heights. As we come to the final days of this Aseret Yemei Tshuva, as we continue in the high holiday season, as we welcome in this new year of 5782, there is so much opportunity for us to leave the past version of ourselves behind and to become an entirely new individual by breaking the addictions, by breaking the negative habits, by breaking some of the bad rituals that we've started for ourselves. And in so doing, and with the help of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, may we have the ability to become these new versions of ourselves and all walk into a new brave world of one united community past this pandemic, past this crazy time that we're living in, to a new special world where we can all be united in our goal of breaking these addictions and growing closer to Hashem. Wish everyone a beautiful evening, a Shavua Tov, and a Gemara Chasima Tova. Good night all.
Thank you, Rabbi.